Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of umoja, embrace with love.
Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right. Stop the fussing and the
right
fighting.
Right now, right now.
Now's the time to do the right, right thing. Let's do it right now. We've got to do it right.
Right now.
That's right. That's right. We are going to do it right. And thank you for joining us. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. And this is the place where we talk about the struggles. We connect the struggles that people are having, not just in this country, but all across the world. People are fighting against racism, against homophobia, patriarchy, Islamophobia. It's so many issues, but they are in many ways connected. And so that's the beauty of having people on the battlefield talk about it, because then we could see, first of all, that we are not isolated and that these issues are connected. So, you know, having said that, we are live here at Harris-Stowe State College. And we, there's Harris-Stowe State University, one of our HBCUs and Hall of Fame, Black Radio Hall of Fame. So we are here. And we also want to say that the opinions expressed on this show by me and my guest are not necessarily those of Harris-Stowe University or Black Radio Hall of Fame. So having said that, I want to welcome my guest, Brother Amari Sanarafu, and thank you for joining us today, really.
Absolutely. Again, for those who don't know me, my name is Amari Sanarafu. I'm the Minister of Pan-African Affairs for the Universal African People's Organization, commonly known in this community as the UAPO. I want to say that I am honored to be a guest on your show, as I consider you to be an icon as it relates to the fight for justice and for human dignity, not only in this community, but I would say across America as a whole.
Yeah, and thank you for that.
I also want to give a shout out to the members of OBS, your organization. A shout out to the Temple of Heteru, the Junior Black Chamber of Commerce, and the African Diaspora Council, as these are the social vehicles that allow me to serve the interests of Black people in this community.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I definitely want to give a shout out to the newspaper, because that's what struck me when I saw your particular article. And it resonated with me because I've been thinking about this for a while, and I know other people have too, particularly when we look at Project 2025 and we start to wonder, okay, how are our communities organized to not only resist, but to protect ourselves and our families? And so tell me a little bit about how this article came about, and it's Bracing for Black Collateral Damage. And that to me is just so powerful, a headliner, because when we think about Black existence here in these shores, when America sneezes, we get the flu, or we get something even more worse than everybody else. So the whole notion that we're here and that we're going to benefit from all of the goodness has never really happened. And so the way that you draw the history and bring it to that conclusion, I think, was just really, really revealing and illuminating. So talk about what made you even write about this.
Well, I appreciate that. I definitely encourage folks to read the article. But first of all, if you don't mind, I would like to extend a huge congratulations to the UNIAACL, the Universal Negro Improvement Association, and African Communities League, the Island of Jamaica, and the Global Pan-African Community for the posthumous pardon of the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey, granted by former President Joe Biden in less than 24 hours of him leaving office.
Yeah.
I want to say congratulations as well to his remaining family members as Joe Biden admitted himself in an official statement, that Marcus Garvey's case in particular involved a miscarriage of justice. So I just wanted to say that. But as far as...
Amari, can I just say something about that? Because I think that's important. Mm-hmm. Because what it does is give us another opportunity to talk about who Marcus Garvey is to people, not just young people, but people who don't know who he is and his contributions to Black liberation. So I think it gives us that opportunity, and I hope we don't miss it or squander it, because people are like, who is that? Who is that man? So yeah, and especially the way he's dressed, it's like, wait a minute, what era did he come out of? But I was kind of shocked that he did that, because I didn't even know that Marcus Messiah Garvey was even up for that, because it's so many folks who've been wrongfully, done in by the judicial system. So yeah, we definitely appreciate that.
Well, during Barack Obama's presidency, twice I received a letter online asking for a signature to get Marcus Garvey pardoned by Obama, and I was told. I don't know how true it is, but I was told that the letter never made it to his desk. His people didn't allow it to even get to his desk, if you want to believe that. But unsuccessfully, it was requested from Obama to get that done for us. But for Joe Biden to pull it off in less than 24 hours before he left office, it really gave me a good feeling. It doesn't solve everything, but it does remove Garvey from the perspective of being some kind of a con man, which if you would Google him, sometimes you would find disrespectful, unappreciative comments about this person who is actually one of the greatest Pan-Africanists or one of the greatest Black figures of the 20th century and one of the greatest figures of our history, period. And I think it can't be overstated all the things that he's done for us in terms of giving us an example of what it looks like to lead a liberation movement,
right?
And for him to be prosecuted for mail fraud, put in jail, and then extradited based on a corrupt judge for one thing, and then for Biden to give us this pardon, I think that helped a little bit in terms of his legacy, and I think that was critical for us to have something like that happen.
Absolutely. So having said that, that is still a good segue to our conversation about bracing for Black collateral damage under the new administration, because we have a convicted felon now in the White House who's using all of his power and privileges to take away the constitutional rights of citizens in this country. And for us who have a troubled and challenging history in this country, what does that say for us? So I think the original question was, what made you even want to write about it in this way?
Well, what really made me want to write about it is that I'm deeply concerned about the naivety of a lot of Black people in our society, because we've gone through possibly our lifetime, maybe 60, 70, 80 years of relatively stability compared to other countries. We haven't seen the level of violence, let's say, like what's happening in Europe today, or it was happening in Haiti and other places. I don't think that we can perceive something tragic or extreme happening in America. So, and I think that this country is very capable of that. So it is important that we begin to shake up people up and say, hey, you better pay attention. You better pay attention, because this fascist energy is extremely dangerous. And they're doing all of the things that was done in Nazi Germany in terms of laying the foundation for this mad violence to take place, all the ranting about DEI. I have a take on that. I believe that that's a setup, because usually before you do your thing, set up the environment, you set up the propaganda campaign. And everybody's concerned about deportation, but we better be worried about mass unemployment of government black government workers, because I believe that this DEI rhetoric is really setting the table to fire a lot of Black people from the government as government workers. And when that happens, all hell is going to break loose. You know, and I just think we begin need to start thinking about what we can do to start setting up resistance for this kind of nonsense that might be coming out of the country.
Yeah, I think the number of federal employees that are going to be impacted is something like 65,000. And, you know, that's one of the places where Black people have often gone to get jobs that they thought was secure because they had benefits. You know, they had some amount of protections. Some of them were even unionized. So you're right. But I think that Black folks have had some glimpses of the kind of violence that can be heaped upon us when necessary. And those have not been in the not too distant future. So I don't know, unless they've been under a rock, what this country can do mm-hmm. to any sector of people that they deem dangerous. And so, so when I look, I've been studying Nazism first of all, I find it very fascinating that one mm-hmm. person can get a whole country in tune and, with such a draconian philosophy about other people and did it over a fairly short amount of time. And so, and we saw it happen here with the Japanese internment, how people turned against those folks in their communities. So we've got examples here of how that can happen. I'm thinking to your point about Black folks being a bit naive, and some of it I think is this whole, savior theory. Somebody's going to come in and save us. You know, they're not going to let us completely get, annihilated. But that's not always true. So, you laid out some of the historical examples, whether it be, for example, what happened to us under Reconstruction, and we certainly saw violence perpetrated. Now, true enough, that was at the turn of the century, but, during the civil rights period, during the Black Power movement, even during the George Floyd, we mm-hmm. saw the kind of intensity. But, we also got a chance to see what weapons they have to do this in terms of urban mm-hmm. rebellions. And so what is your greatest fear when you think about what could happen to Black people under that kind of a siege?
Well, I think about, this man's rhetoric, Donald Trump, and Project 2025, which they pretty much outlined what they'd like to do. I just think that if they want to turn back the clock, and then Donald Trump actually want to release the shackles from their hands in terms of police violence. On his first day in office, he, Barack Obama had began to phase away for-profit prisons, right? And then when Donald Trump got in, he, did executive order to reverse that and put him back into play. Biden got in, and then he, in turn, executive order, did the same thing that Barack Obama did. He started to phase them out again. For-profit prisons, it gives the prison an incentive to see Black people locked up because why? They make a profit. Right. And so I think that, this man doing what he did is an indication of what side he's leaning to. He also did an executive order to reinstall the legality of chokeholds. Now, like he did on the during January 6th when he said, hey man, there's some people out there with weapons. He said, well, I'm not worried about that because they're not going to use them on me. And that's the same way I feel about this. They're not worried about the chokehold because the chokehold is going to be used on us. And so he re-implemented these things on day one. And so I'm talking about the possible level of violence that maybe the Palestinians are seeing. We haven't seen that, in the last century and a half. That's frightening, but it's possible when you're talking about fascism, because the first thing that fascism does, it tries to destroy the media or either manipulate the media and replace it with propaganda. So if violence took place in St. Louis, they would try to make sure it wouldn't be aired nationally. So you wouldn't know unless they did something to stop social media. So these are the things that we really got to be concerned about. And I tried to outline a few of those things compacted in one or two sentences because I wanted to cover so much ground, but I tried to squeeze it in there.
So when you talk about, for example, the communications network would be shut down, and that's one of the things that, you know, I talk to young activists and organizers about. We need to start looking at how we will communicate should the internet be shut down. And now that Zuckerman is all, you know, up in kissing Trump's ring, you know, and saying he no longer would be doing fact checking, that is also one of the first signs of fascism. Like the truth is the first to go. And so not only do you have disinformation, you have sometimes no information, as you said, because if it's shut down, we have no way of knowing what's going on anywhere, down the street, let alone across the country. So what can we start doing now, Amari, to really, without this whole alarmist thing? Because sometimes I feel like I'm the town crier because, you know, I have access to the media, and I feel like it's my responsibility to let people know what's getting ready to happen. But then when I read back on it, I said, this sounds a bit alarmist. And so are people then going to say, oh, here comes Jamala, or here comes Amari again with that black stuff. We okay, we cool in this country. They're not going to let that happen to us. Well, how do we get people to understand that with this man now in office, all of that is gone, pretty much. All those safety precautions are gone.
Well, first of all, we are brilliant, brilliant people. But we have to start conversations. The conversation you mentioned, how will we develop a communications process that we can communicate with each other? That's the kind of conversations we need to start having now. Because once we put our minds and focus and our attention on that, we will come up with some solutions. But we have to start having that conversation. If we started having a conversation about Nelly. I think they're talking about Nelly right now and his performance at the inaugural, which I'm kind of disappointed, but it's not the first time we've seen that kind of disappointment. But, you know, it's so close to home that this brother, right, you know, using the justification that, hey, I buy kids Christmas toys every year. So I do a lot for St. Louis in the community. So how dare you criticize me for supporting or performing for a man that you say that's what he's.
Right.
The job is so anti-black. Well, you know, I think he's informed enough to really speak on that. I don't think he really understands that, yeah, you're giving folks Christmas gifts and you think you're serving a community, but when a man like that who undermines your mother or father, who getting Social Security or Medicaid, your relatives getting Medicaid, that you're supporting a guy that's really maybe taking those things away. And how will that impact your community? How will that impact your family? How will your family look at you when they know that you supported this man as he began to take away maybe some of the foundational things that they need in order to survive month from month to month? I mean, that's a reality. Yeah. Project 2025 mentioned that they're going to be trying to take away Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. So Those are conversations that we need to start having in terms of what kind of get with the churches and start talking about what kind of safety nets are we going to start to provide for our people if these things take place.
I'm thinking though with the Nelly running up there to perform, this is also another one of the features of the propaganda that fascists use. They use people that folks knew and trust to then usher in and say, well, Nelly was there. He must not be that bad. So I just found it a very dangerous, folks have a right to perform wherever they want to. But then to his point about we shouldn't be criticizing him, we have just as much right to criticize you as you have a right to go up there and perform. So I just think that for him to say that is also playing into what Trump says. You can't criticize me. I'm the president and I have unilateral control and this, that, and the other. You start to hear these things that you heard under fascism, under Nazism, and you say, wow, we are on a slippery slope. So for some of those other black men that were up there talking about why, you know, trying to justify why they were up there, To me, it is a dangerous thing, because when I look at, for example, the people overestimated and overrated the number of Black men who voted for Trump. But at the same time, here's some Black men that are there supporting Trump and getting paid to perform and get paid for other things. It opened up the door for other Black men to say, well, hey, you know, this is free enterprise. Maybe I should be trying to, you know, suck up to the ex-con and see what he has for me, because that's exactly what the white folks, the white corporations are doing. They are like knocking each other over to see how they can like get in line and get some of the goodies. And most of the goodies are going to be our, from our tax dollars.
Well, you know, the sad thing about it, though, like I said, you know, a lot of people are going to be looking to us. We're the conscious community. We're the pro-Black. We're the ones who you guys are getting ready to have your 45th anniversary. UAPO, for 35 years, we've been doing this kind of work. So as fascism comes to America, they're going to be running to us for answers. So I think it behooves us to really have some serious conversations with each other, and time to come together and try to provide some answers and some strategies and solutions. And we have been working on a few things as an organization, but that's why it was so important to not even let it get to this point. That election, like I say, in 2020, when Joe Biden ran against Trump and won, 12% of Black men voted for Donald Trump, of, you know, eligible Black voters. 12% of Black men, as I indicated in the paper, that moved up to 24% of Black males that voted for Donald Trump this go round.
Mm-hmm.
Black women, 6% voted for Donald Trump, which is a very small number for Donald Trump during the 2020 election. But this time, 10% of Black women voted on Donald Trump. So Kamala Harris only lost by 2.5 million votes. We literally could have put her over the top.
Right, right.
And so what hurts is how people, this guy, you know, all of this stuff that we're talking about resisting, the greatest form of resistance was not to even get him in there in the first place. But if you're not educated properly, I guess we failed to fight, because I watched this online stuff with Dr. Umar Johnson, and I'm still feeling that he may have been, you know, reached by Elon Musk, because the way he's behaving, how he was about getting us not to vote on anybody, mm-hmm. trying to show how both parties are no good, mm-hmm. so therefore mm-hmm. you vote the couch, you don't vote on anybody. Right, which is the same right. thing as that's like voting for Donald Trump. So it was a tragedy
exactly.
to see how successful that was and how Black men were used as a tool in order to get Trump over the hump. But that
yeah,
was just terrible.
Yeah. So, yeah. And it's a point to me that also goes to the way that the Democratic Party has utilized our vote and not paid attention to us. But that's probably a whole nother discussion. But one of the things that I think you said in your article is that we as a people, African descent, are going to have to cope with a fascist white nationalist administration without the benefit of legal cover, without the benefit of foreign allies, and without the benefit of domestic militias that would protect us otherwise. To me, that's the crux of it right there, Amari. People don't understand that. Who do we take our grievances to? The courts? Exactly. and who's going to come after us? It's going to be the police, who have been militarized already to sure. come after us. And they're going to be augmented by the National Guard and all these other militias. So how do we address that? These are the sources that we at one point could count on, you know, go to the courts, you know, file a grievance at the police department. Now that stuff is you know, it's been snatched away. So how do we get people to understand that we are the people that we've been waiting for, and there's not going to be anybody, nobody on a white horse coming to save us.
Well, a lot of us marvel at how strong we were and how passionate we were and how out there we were in the 60s, mm-hmm. and what we were able to accomplish in terms of a social change. But you got to keep in mind, we had a liberal Supreme Court. You know, mm-hmm. we had some place to take our grievances. It's gone. This Supreme Court here is more corrupt than Donald Trump. Nobody corrupt than Trump, but only.
Well, a lot of his appointees are on there for that reason. So, yeah.
Absolutely. And Eileen Cannon is on her way to the Supreme Court. You can better believe that. I was talking about DEI, who is totally unqualified, but this is what's getting ready to happen. So, deck is stacked much higher now than it was in the 60s. And so, I think when we start to have these conversations, we have to start looking around the world. Well, the other folks have done, you might have to study and see what they've done. Like, for instance, if you look at the Kurds over in Iraq, I think a lot of them are in Syria. I was always amazed how strong of a community they are. Somehow they were apart. They lived within the confines of another country, which is Iraq and Syria, but they are able to have their own military. Their own militias, peacefully coexist with a government that had a different military. How did they pull that off? We need to study them. You know, they have their own politics. They have their own, you know, way of dealing and communicating with and keeping their culture intact. But I haven't heard a lot in the news about the Israelis, but these are the examples that we need to start studying. How do they survive? Because there was a brother by the name of, I believe it was Master Jay, they kind of leave in my memory. Because I think about 2 years ago, maybe right before COVID, who went down in Kentucky with his Black Power militia, thought it was important that Black people see a strong Black militia. He was neutralized. They found, set him up and took him to court and shut him up and arrested him. And that was a blow of victory for the oppressor. And once again, we just looking for somebody who could protect us. Because in terms of a crisis, people tend to depend on their own militias. It's in the United States Constitution. You have a right to form a militia as a group, but obviously the rules are different when it comes to Black people in America. Those are the types of conversations. Those are different conversations that we've ever had in the African community in America, but we need to start having those. How do we education systems? How do we grapple with the idea that we may need a militia, or if not, how do we begin to set up networks of foreign allies who will look after us or maybe support us in case a foreign country, you know, or in case this country decides to do us the way the Palestinians were done over in Israel?
You know, the point that you made about the brother who went with his militia somewhere and basically got set up and neutralized. See, this is the thing about this whole lone wolf, you know, theory that I'm going to go save the day, when really it has to be a community decision and a community plan, not one person plan, because that's the quick way for you to get isolated. And so I think, you know, the thing that I kept hearing, not just in your article, but even today is, you know, the community is going to have to come together with a plan. And they're going to have to figure out for themselves and the families that reside in that particular neighborhood or in that particular geographical area, how are we going to survive? Should, for example, they decide to cut the food supply? Mm-hmm. So there's so many scenarios of what if this happens that we need to be looking at to see, okay, what would we do, you know, aside from breaking into a grocery store and getting stuff? That's a very limited supply of stuff. That's not going to be forever if they decide not to do that.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. When it comes to, let's say, when the brother was trying to form a militia, he was doing a pretty good job until they put a stop to him. Right. It lacked the political nuance. It lacked the involvement of mainstream political figures to show America that he has a right to do this. And if you got the political nuance that make people feel relaxed about it, make people feel that this is something that needs to be done without intimidating anybody, those component, that component of what he was doing was lacking. That is absolutely necessary in a society like this, where you are already, where folks already fear Black people, especially Black males. Political nuance is absolutely a critical piece to the chessboard if we're able to form us a militia. But if not, we're going to have to be serious about sending ambassadors or delegates to begin to have conversations with folks around the world and see who can support us in our time of need. You know, those are the three things that I mentioned that we got to start with, because the court system, you can forget about, even though Joe Biden, which I admit, was able to set up, he was able to solve at least 235 federal Black liberal judges to the courts. But with the Supreme Court sitting above them, you know, it's still a problem. But that was more Black appointees to the federal bench, which is a lifetime. You know, to speak to that both sides of them, you know, there is no equivalent in terms of as far as what is. This man did more. And I'm not, because this guy, he has a racist past, you know, about the 94 crime bill. But this man, as president, has done more for Black people empowerment any president since Lyndon Johnson. And that's just the fact of the matter. So I'm always disappointed when somebody say Trump XYZ, that you guys say, well, Biden, you don't, that's not necessary, because it's not an equivalence in terms of the danger and in terms of, I mean, this guy being a Black vice president, which I think that speaks a lot. That speaks a lot in terms of what we as organizations always, we push for proportionate political representation. So we had a Black woman in the White House serving as vice president and had an opportunity to have a Black woman as president. And I just think that we in many ways failed to push our own interests to the degree that we won that election, because it's just ridiculous. I outlined the numbers in terms of the Black community's ability to have pulled that out. But even the Hispanic, who I heard the recent statistics, a little different than mine, said that 46% of Hispanics voted on Donald Trump, which is still a huge number for the people who are being threatened in terms of being a deportation.
That's what happened, Amari. What they did was they pitted them against each other. It's like, okay, you all are here legally. Now all these other folks are going to come, and they didn't go the path that you did. I mean, I've heard so many people, and I know they put these folks up. I understand that they put those folks up to say, why should they get to come across the border when I went through the process? So do you see this sort of internal tension in even those communities, all of it orchestrated and perpetuated by the enemies?
So, you know, I know that we have representation. Question is, will they have a voice? You know, we have some strong, intelligent Black folks in Congress. You know, the head of the Democratic Congress in Congress and the House of Representatives is a pretty strong brother. And then, you know, and even in the Senate. But will they have a voice? You know, will they have a speaker loud enough for us to hear? Because when MAGA takes over, you know, they control the microphone. They control, the speaker. And that's the thing we got to worry about. Not people who can really resist or fight against the things that are being said in terms of propaganda.
I think they have to do the same thing we're talking about right now. They have to create another mechanism to get to their constituents. Should the stuff be shut down? And I don't even know if they're thinking in those terms. I would love to hear what the Black Congressional Caucus resetting what their strategy is or what their plan of actions is for 2025. I haven't heard anything. What I do know, because I had a conversation with somebody that says, oh, when Wesley Bell goes there, he got paid all of that Zionist money. And now he's going to be up there with the caucus, and he's going to find that they don't support that. But that's not true. Most of the Black Congressional Caucus supports Israel. They support the Zionists. So he's going to be in good company. So when I think about what are the mechanisms we have to hold people accountable in a time like this, when we didn't do it when we had times of peace, like the task is going to be that much harder, don't you think?
Absolutely. I think the conversation that you and I are having right now, I think we need to have this same conversation with our congressional representatives. Can you help us establish a communication system? What if you got to organize with blue states or blue state governors, what can you do with those resources to help us organize a communication system in case this Project 2025 gets off the ground? Find positions to really more have to get results more so than the grassroots community, but it is incumbent upon us to reach out to them to get all of the help, because we got to come together and use everything that we have at our disposal in terms of getting those mechanisms in place so that we can communicate, and two, so that we can protect ourselves. Yep. Not only protect ourselves from the bullet or the chokeholds of the police officer, but also protect ourselves financially for what may happen to us in terms of when you start taking away, I mean, the average Black family, whether it be the parents or grandparents or the uncle or aunt, that security check, that supplement, they might have other forms of income, but that's carrying them from month to month. Mm-hmm. You take that away, that grandson or that nephew might not be able to afford to even feed you, you know, as you stay with parents or, you know, still have their children at home. And and when these government workers get kicked out of there, because Project 2025 said they wanted to replace people with Trump loyalists. Cold word for we want to get rid of Black folks, because Black folks are traditional Democrats.
Right, right.
They keep saying DEI, that's a code, you know, that we're going to give. It's been done before. I believe it was Woodrow Wilson. And when he was elected, he got rid of all the Black people who were working in the government at that time. We need to really and have these conversations with our congressional representatives.
What do you think about the plan that needs to happen around, I mean, you talked about jobs and what happens when people lose those jobs, but there's also this whole thing of people, the businesses that are going to close, the agencies that are going to close, when consumers don't have money to spend, it's a ripple effect. And so we saw that during COVID. Like when people weren't out spending, restaurants closed down, the small mom and pop stores closed down. And so, you know, I go to the worst case scenario here and think about what if businesses start closing down, we don't have grocery stores, we're already in food deserts. How would people sustain themselves in a way that even if they have a few dollars, there's gonna be some people still working. But what 2025 tells us is that amount of money that's going to social services will be reduced. That money then is going to go into the military and the defense budget, not just for our enemies abroad, but who they are claiming to be enemies within. And so that's the part that I don't think our people understand. Is they're reducing all of the safety nets we have. You got that clown that Kennedy that's going to be head of Health and Human Services. Mm-hmm. He doesn't even believe in like medicine. He doesn't believe in all this stuff. So we're going to have a holistic approach to what you're saying is the survival part of it if we are to sustain ourselves. So what does that look like for you? A total picture of what we need to be thinking about.
Well, first of all, it has to be proactive, because chaos is their plan. You know, once it gets down to chaos, then you can have mass incarceration. And with this incarceration, so I'll visualize this, because we know how they think. We hear for 400 years, we know right, we're the only right. people in the world that really know this man and how he moves. So we're talking about when they talking about it's a distraction, they're always talking about mass deportation. But all of that noise, as I mentioned it, if they were to get rid of those migrant workers, which is the foundation a big part of the American economy, believe, because I know how they think. Through this chaos, they get mass incarceration of Black males. And that mass incarceration in these private, for-profit prison systems, their Black males will then take the place of the migrant workers by force. In other words, if I give you lesser time on your sentence, you get out here and work. Then they reinstituting slavery by way of mass incarceration, which is in the 13th Amendment, which is legally possible for them to do. But this
and,
is how
we saw work. That we saw that how that worked when you had like this whole it wasn't even underground where Black people were just picked up for no good reason and then made to work for little or nothing for years under a legal system, the penal That's system. Right. And so I don't, we've seen it before. So all they got to do is reinstitute it.
Absolutely.
And when people don't have money to feed their families, they're going to do it by any means necessary. And so that means in some ways breaking laws. It means, break into a store or snatch somebody's purse. So there you have it. You know, the pathway to these, institutions that are, producing goods and services for the ruling class. And so I think the point that you made about mass education around Absolutely. Project 2025 and what it means, then I think would help people to understand the urgency of us as a community coming together to think through some of these ways that we're going to protect and defend ourselves.
A very aggressive African centered education, because if you don't know your history, you're vulnerable for that history to be repeated on you at your, demise. And so we talked about the penance system. If our young people don't know about that history, so this might be an opportunity for us to move swiftly and aggressively about having conferences about developing independent education. Because they're telling you to your face, they're going to remove Black history from the schools. What other signals do we need? The time is now to start getting serious about developing independent educational system for our people to cover all of these issues that need to be addressed.
Right, right. I'm also thinking about one on in other cities. Some cities and communities have been thinking about this and are moving. And I don't know that they are widely saying what they are going to do, which, I respect and understand. But we also need to be trying to figure out how to communicate with other people, because there may be a time when some of us are going to be underground or on the run. And mm-hmm. where do we go? I mean, so we have some semblance of a historical plan that was part of the underground. But it means that you identify certain people and places that you can go. And that needs to be starting right now.
Absolutely, absolutely. Look, was brought down, and you see, he found refuge in Russia. So you got to have those relationships outside these borders, and that's one of our problems as a people. We think reality is only exists within the borders of the United States. We're gonna have to start opening up our minds and our relationships with people around the world, starting with the continent, and other places. Start to have some close relationship and start developing strong allies and see what they can do. I don't know. We have to start talking to BRICS and that side out of the world and see and bring our grievances to them, in case this gets out of hand over here in America. But we're going to have to start having serious conversations. And it begins, I say, with those quote unquote blue state governors or blue state congressmen and senators. Because they, like I said before, are in a position to at least have resources or either control some degree of resources for me being able to do these things quickly.
And we said some resources, because already Trump is saying that the blue states, he's going to be cutting back on some of those federal dollars that they have been receiving, and was very ugly and blatant about what's going on in California with the fires. He basically said, y'all not getting anything until you do what I say you're going to do. So just really emasculating, the mayors and the governors of these blue states. So I'm wondering, what resources will they have and will they be struggling? And then it makes me think about countries like Haiti and Cuba, who the United States has put all these, you know, obstacles in terms of them being independent and having some autonomy, because if you can get stuff in to take care of yourself, then you open to whoever's going to bring those goods and services to you. And that may not be the friend. That may not, that person or that entity may not be your friend. So I just think that this whole notion of where we are right now and what we need to do may feel daunting for a lot of people. And it is, because like you said, we've never been here before, or we've been in a similar situation, but I don't know that we've been in a situation, A, that we had a convicted felon who has a history of ignoring laws, abusing laws, breaking laws, that mm-hmm. now has unlimited powers that we haven't seen before. Go ahead.
Some kind of leverage, like for instance, the state of California, I believe is the sixth largest economy in the world. And in California, that state actually does trade with other countries. So my point is, they have the leverage. They pay a big portion of America's taxes. So they have leverage when this guy tried to move on them. And the governor understands that. So blue states, and like I say, you got Illinois and the state of New York, they have power. The question is, how will they leverage that power in terms of being able to resist? They're really in the best position to resist the fascism more so than, you know, small operating community. So that we want to have talk to them about how do we plug into them leveraging their power and then maybe us fitting under that umbrella of protection with those blue states. I don't think mass migration to blue states is the answer. That's not
probably. I was going to ask you about either blue states are going to Africa. Some people are wanting to do dual citizenship to completely leave. I don't think it's feasible either, because a bunch of us got to stay. I mean, because we got no choice. So what do we do here while we're here?
Because responsibilities. There's a lot of people we're responsible for who may not be that progressive in their minds. You know, things got to be taken care of. You know, we have uh-huh. families and responsibilities. So we're going to act wherever we are, but you know, as an individual, I'm in my 60s, so I'm passionate about Africa. I would to live in Africa, you know, in a perfect world. But the bottom line is, we're going to have to fight wherever we are, and even to get through this 4 years or 2 years, because I have a hunch that by the time the midterms get here, this man is probably going to try to suspend the midterm. Now, I'm the first one to say that. Remember that I said that. This guy is going to call for a suspension of the midterm.
I don't get the first one, because I've read it before, suspension of the midterms and also rewriting the Constitution so that he, you know, has unlimited terms. So all of that can be done because they have enough, I believe, with the Republicans to do a constitutional, what they call a constitutional assembly. Amendment. Yeah, to do that. And so... and then because we don't have the numbers in Congress, you know, we can expect, I just think we should expect a illegal government operating and we have to figure out how we're going to save ourselves.
The power of an illegal government is their ability to enforce what they claim they're trying to do. This man already tried, you know, attack the 14th Amendment. On day one, you know.
Right.
You know, but the question going to fall in enforcement. Will he be able to get members of the military, the armed forces, or everybody in the police department to cooperate when it's time to enforce things? For example, against blue states. Are they going to actually go into those blue states and try to pull out and do that mass deportation? What kind of resistance will they have within the department? You know, police departments are within the National Guard and the other military branches. You know, so that's where the chaos is also to be expected.
So in the few minutes that we have left, Amari, what should we be focusing in, say, in the next 100 days? What should Black folks be concentrating on?
Need to be, like this guy on his first day, Biden and him had just reduced the cost of medicine. This guy hurts that day one. So he's trying to hurt the city. I mean, it's coming. It's clear what he's trying to do. So what we got to do is begin to, I believe, start to reach out. You know, the Urban League has been doing a great job in terms of, feeding folks in the community. But we're going to have to start organizing networks, including the churches, and begin to have conversation with them about what if these resources are taken? What can we do together to make sure people have food, to make sure people, we can raise enough money to get their medicine? These are the conversations that we need to start having immediately in terms of, you know, our security from a physical standpoint and a financial standpoint.
Yeah, the discussion about the conditions that we're in, because I think for most people, like you said, you know, we are not a stupid people, but, you know, we get a lot of distractions and a lot of disinformation. But once we get the information, we tend to move. We tend to do the right thing. So I definitely agree with you there. So we're going to be having these discussions, Amari, from here on out. And I do believe the first 100 days is going to set the tone for the country. Because he did it the first day. I mean, he had a desk full of executive orders, like that was rolling back the time. And so I think it's clear what he's going to do. And they've been talking about it in Project 2025. It's not clear what we can do or going to do or need to do. And so I agree with you. Our next step is to really come together to have a discussion about the plan, our plan to survive America in 2025. Yeah. Amari Sanefu, thank you for joining me. I've told people that UAPO's paper, the African News World, has it all in there. So you could go there and you could see the article, Bracing for Black Collateral Damage, read it. And, you know, it's got a lot of other good information as well. So let's be safe out there. This is Jamala, your host. And I will see you on the battlefield.
Thank you. Right now. Right now.